Bobbig.
Hello, I'm Steffi from Berlin, and this talk is about my previous work on a firewall for CubesOS, a security-focused operating system that is used by activists and journalists. The firewall is written in the functional programming language OCaml. The work is open source and funded by the German Ministry of Education, the BMBF, via the Prototype Fund. Really nice fund for open source projects. Since then, I've been working on the search stack at DuckDuckGo. The goal of this talk is to be useful for users of all operating systems. Let's start by defining a firewall and a network. So, a firewall, the word comes from a literal wall in construction that is used to inhibit the spread of fire, or in our case, unwanted network traffic. So, what is a network in our context? A network is a group of connected computers, of course, and they talk to each other by exchanging streams of bits. So, starting from the actual hardware, different levels of abstraction describe the hardware network devices, the data connection, the different types of transport packets, and the application that we can see on the screen. So, we all remember this layer model, right? And of major importance is TCP/IP, which consists of the transmission control protocol and the internet protocol. And rather than just sending characters through the wire, TCP/IP divides larger blocks of data into smaller packets, which are sent separately over the transmission line. So often this could be a telephone line, and then they are reassembled on the other end. And if a packet gets lost along the way, TCP takes care of sending it again and ensures that the information is transmitted in a reliable way. And the popular visual part of the internet, the World Wide Web, makes use of HTTP. So, yeah, that would be all the way up in the stack, would be up here. How do the connected computers find each other? Like phones, they have a number, but it's called an address. So, I'm gonna type some commands in my terminal app to find these numbers. So I can find the IP address of bobconf.de. It is here, 185 something something. And then we can look up our own IP address of this computer I'm recording on right now. I can use the command ifconfig to do this. Okay. Yeah, and it looks like we have different versions of IP addresses here. But this one looks like before, so this is the IP version 4 address. And to see if we can send and receive traffic from bobconf.de, we can send a diagnostic test packet. You've probably all done this. We can do this using the ping command. Okay, let's stop here. Three packets transmitted, three packets received. Looking good, I would say. And then when the IPv4 address was created, engineers did not anticipate how big the internet would become. So there's a limited amount of public IP addresses that are available and used by the entire world. And with the way an IP address is constructed, there are over 4 billion addresses available. So I think this seems plenty, but the internet got even bigger than that. So I looked this up. There are now 7.7 billion humans and around the same number of internet-connected devices around the globe at this time, and it's growing, right? Nowadays, even light bulbs can have IP addresses, so yeah, we have a problem. We need to find a workaround to work with this limited number of addresses. And to do this, people came up with a NAT, or called network address translation. It is being used in routers to translate one set of IP addresses to another set of IP addresses, and vice versa. Public addresses are publicly registered on the internet, and they look like 90.187, 178.37.21, or something like that. And private addresses are not registered. They cannot directly access the internet, but are rather connecting computers inside a home, or a school, or a business, or a conference, like back in the day when we used to meet in person. And they look like something like 10 point something. Something, something, or 192, 168 point something point something. You've already seen these. And then Even though these addresses are constructed in the same fashion, private addresses will not be routed. They will not be passed on to the internet by convention. So what do we do instead? In our home, we have multiple devices and they all want to access the internet. So they need a public IP address for that. And IP addresses are provided by your internet service provider and are expensive. And they waste addresses from this pool of public addresses that we just talked about, right? So we want to share one address among all the devices. Our router assigns the devices inside the network some private IP address. And when the device needs to access the internet, it will be translated by NAT into a public address. Private to public and public to private. If a computer on the internet talks to our device, we need to translate the public address into a private address. And in the future, everything will be different. Maybe the future is already now. It's not evenly distributed, right? In the future, each device will have its own public IP address, so there will be no need for NAT anymore. And that's the case because we are going to have IP version 6, and it will have 340 undecillion IP addresses. So that's 340 with 46 digits after. That's a number too big to comprehend for me. It's more than 666 billion addresses per grain of sand in the Earth's crust. So now that we know everything about NAT, let's talk a bit about network protocols. How do they work and how do we look inside? Remember the test packets we send via ping? Ping uses a network protocol called ICMP, Internet Control Message Protocol. A protocol is some sort of standardized envelope. It separates the address from the content of the packet. And before I send my ping packet, I can enable also capturing this traffic. I can record these packets and I can capture the ICMP traffic on that network interface with a tool called TCP dump. So let's try this out. I'm writing it out to a file with W. The file is called ping.pcap and pcap is the packet capture format. To filter out distracting other traffic, I use the option I to pick the interface, and I also pick the protocol for ping, ICMP, right? And now let's look at the captured packets. For this, we can use a tool called Wireshark. It's really awesome, and it lets you capture and analyze packets in a visual way. As expected, we see two packets, so we stopped here immediately. We see our ping request and the reply from bobconf.de. And we can look into the packets to learn about the structure of the protocols. The packet is also called a frame, and a larger request might be chunked up into many of these frames, but the ping request is tiny, right? Inside the frame, we see Ethernet 2, which marks the header of the Ethernet protocol, and this whole thing is like a Russian doll. And inside the Ethernet frame, there's the IPv4 packet. And inside the IPv4 packet, there's finally our ICMP packet. In the bottom, we can see each part of the packet in the hexadecimal format. It's a more human readable version of the binary format. Right? So now that we can listen to our own traffic, who else can listen to it? Let's have a look. Let's try something. I put a file on my server called secrets.txt, or secret.txt, which contains a secret. I'm downloading this file and again capturing network traffic. Curl is just downloading it and that's all, and it works and I can receive the secret and read it. So let's have a look. Let's look at the captured traffic again. We are now sending actual information and not just test packets. That means we are going to use the main protocol of the internet, TCP/IP. It deals with the chunking of our requested website to fit into multiple packets, right? If I use Wireshark, just like before, to look into the packets that we recorded, I can now use this handy feature, follow TCP stream, pretty cool. There it is. And as we can see, we see nothing. The traffic is end-to-end encrypted on the transport layer. Only my browser, or in this case, my curl program, has the key. No person in between, for example, no router in a coffee shop, or not even my Wireshark, can see my traffic. It's nice. If, on the other hand, I were to go to google.cn in China, things would look different. All of my search results would be clearly readable by everybody along the way because it's HTTP and not HTTPS. Great, now we know everything we need to know about networking, for this talk at least. Let's talk a bit about CubeSOS. CubeSOS is an operating system just like Windows or macOS or Linux. It's based on the Debian Linux distribution, and its tagline is a reasonably secure operating system. Instead of running directly on the hardware is abstracted by a software that is called the hypervisor. Nowadays, everybody talks about the cloud, or everybody works in the cloud, and in the cloud, storage, bandwidth, and CPU time is endless, provided you pay enough money. This transition was made possible by hypervisors. In Google's or Amazon's data centers, we don't really know, or we don't really care what hardware a compute job runs on, what the CPU specific features for speed up or other things like that. That's details, right? These details are abstracted away by the hypervisor. How can we use this abstraction to our benefit on our own machine? In CubeSOS, the Xen hypervisor is used to run several virtual machines called cubes. If you follow common security updates, security lists, and stuff like that, new unpatched vulnerabilities pop up on a regular basis, and this applies to all operating systems. Nobody's safe. Do you remember the Heartbleed bug? Almost everybody was affected. So if we keep it real, there is no way to completely be safe from bugs and vulnerabilities, even with regular updates. So if we can't stop an intruder completely, how can we minimize the harm they can cause? We could do it like a submarine. We can compartmentalize and use some waterproof doors in between. Out of the box, cubes comes with many different types of VMs. Even untrusted, disposable ones, or you could have a separate one for your activist work, or you open a PDF and you don't trust this driver, you make a new VM, a throwaway one. And there's also a separate NetVM by default, and the display and keyboard is also in a separate VM. To enhance anonymity, it's also possible to use Tor, the Onion router, we're going to talk about it later, by choosing Hunix as a NetVM. There's a bit of memory overhead because of the many virtual machines. It runs best on a computer with a lot of memory. Overall, the operating system is nice. The different cubes have different colored borders, and there's extra commands for clipboard and for copying to and from virtual machines or cubes. It does need the so-called virtualization bits on the CPU, and some peripheral hardware like a camera might not work maybe. But yeah, it works pretty well on my 5-year-old ThinkPad. And virtualization is the future anyway because it abstracts away the right part, the computing environment. If the environment were to change in the future, we could still run it alongside older environments. If you ever downloaded a game emulator or things like that, it's exactly the same and can probably run on the underlying Xen system as a virtual machine. The firewall is built, we built it, it's a bit of a strange cube because it's based on a different operating system. It's based on the library operating system Mirage OS, which builds tiny operating system kernels without any Linux code in a more safe programming language. Also, since it's so tiny, it needs way less memory than the traditional Linux firewall in CubeSOS, and memory is a very limited resource in this virtualized world, right? So let's unpack this a bit. The Mirage OS approach is interesting as an approach for us because it's very radical considering the emerging trends in systems engineering. It takes the trends around microservices, containerization, and hardware abstraction very seriously, and it can do so because it's based on the functional programming language OCaml. OCaml is an old modern programming language, and it has been around as a secret pocket chainsaw of people who write compilers or their parts like parsers and type checkers for decades. It got some mainstream attention recently when Facebook introduced types into their PHP code base via a gradual type checker written in OCaml. And since then, they maintain a different dialect of OCaml. It's called Reason. OCaml is great for writing these programs because it provides a good balance of strictness from the purely functional realm and practicality from the imperative realm. It has modern language features like automatic memory management, so we don't need to think about it. First-class functions that can be passed around like ordinary values. Static type checking to increase performance and reduce the number of runtime errors. Parametric polymorphism, so we can abstract across different data types, similar to generics in Java and templates in C++. It has also good support for immutable programming, and you need to use a special syntax to allow destructive updates to your data, so this keeps state creep in check, we could say, automatically. And it has type inference, so we don't need to annotate every single variable with this type, but it's being inferred based on usage. And algebraic data types and pattern matching can be used to manipulate complex data structures like in Scala or F#. So it's very good for dealing with abstract syntax trees. It just feels natural. In practice, larger modern web applications use multiple small backend services to keep the infrastructure more modular and easier to monitor, troubleshoot, and reason about. Often they also try to freeze the state of the operating system image, code versions and dependencies via containerization, a Docker file, or some similar build chain. If we think about these trends in a radical way, how about starting from scratch for each service and building a bespoke operating system kernel for the service using the library operating system? With this idea, every kernel has a single purpose and the general purpose code can be omitted, which makes the code base very small. This is called the unikernel approach. OCaml has a powerful module system. Modules can take other modules as input. We can use it to construct a chain of dependencies in a functional way and only include libraries when we need them. Our firewall, for example, doesn't store anything on a hard disk, so it doesn't need any file system. When building a new application, we can mix and match libraries, such as a server library and different network protocols. And as a software developer, I spend most of my time in a virtual machine. I don't know about you, or some sort of dev instance on a cloud platform. And virtualization makes it easy to share existing hardware among multiple developers and gives developers the freedom of picking their computing environment independently from the underlying host system and its peculiarities. And we can easily spin up new instances as needed. Since virtualization is so convenient, why not target the virtualization layer, also called the hypervisor, directly? Hardware and drivers are already handled by the hypervisor, and we can keep our operating system kernel minimal. We don't need all that stuff. Our system calls become hypercalls to the hypervisor, and the interface becomes small and very, very simple. Okay, now that we have all these building blocks assembled, let's take a look at the firewall. This is in the unikernel.ml OCaml file. But before we start, let's have a look at the structure. This diagram shows the main components. Each box in this diagram corresponds to a source.ml file. So it's an OCaml file with the same name. And we have our personal cubes on the left. So work and personal and so on. And then we have the uplink netvm cube on the right. And at the top we have kubesdb, which contains the firewall rules from the cubes menus. And at the bottom we have xenstore, which is used to see whether a new VM has been started in kubes. If we look at the code, it's actually not that much code. So yeah, it's below 2,000 lines of code if we just take the ML files. Yeah, so it's pretty small. It's so small we can actually talk about it in this talk. The main entry point is the file unikernel.ml. Let's look at the two most important functions, the network listener and the start function. So here's the network listener. Don't worry if you've never read OCaml code before. We can do it. It's very small. It receives a clock for the system time, a net table in which we are going to note down the connections that have been established in their translation when we're translating the IP addresses. And it gets the kubes DB from which it will read the firewall rules. Then we are going to read the network configuration from kubesdb, which holds all global kubes settings. And then we are going to connect the uplink by establishing a connection to kubesOS netvmkube, and this one guards the access to the network interface. Afterwards, we are preparing our client network, which will know everything about the client kubes which are behind the firewall kube, and they want to access the internet. As a last step, we're going to set up the router, which shepherds the packets from the NetVM and the client networks, and it knows about the IP addresses and the entries in the net table and knows where which one should go. This part is needed because we want to handle packets from the client network and the uplink, and MirageOS uses lightweight threads. Lightweight threads, or LWT as we write here, are similar to promises in JavaScript or futures in Scala. We list the two alternatives in a declarative way, and choose will wait for at least one of these promises to resolve and use it as an answer. The main function, so to say, is called the start function in a unikernel. Here the start function just gets a clock so we can measure connection times. The clock is provided by MirageOS when specified in the unikernel configuration file. Using the clock, we note the start time of the unikernel. Then we start connecting to KubesOS services, the remote execution interface, the graphical user interface, and the global kube settings database, kubesdb. When all of them are connected, we note down the time again and compute and output the startup time. We already have the remote execution agent listener, but we also need to listen for shutdown requests from kubes in case the firewall is supposed to stop or restart. As a final step, we build the net table and we have all the arguments to call our network listener function we defined earlier, remember? So now we can call it, finally, and then yeah, the rest is basically housekeeping. The memory pressure code reports the memory we use from the net table, and if the net table gets too big, it purges the memory when it gets close to the limits that we are granted by Xen for our firewall kube. And the lightweight thread then again chooses the between these three alternatives. This function is already familiar, the choose function, and it runs the QRX agent listener, the network listener, and the shutdown listener until one of them resolves. How do we configure our firewall rules? For a home router, we usually want to block all incoming traffic. On KubesOS, we might use Tor for anonymization on a VM. Anonymity is particularly important for journalists and activists in marginalized groups or oppressive regimes, so they can avoid getting targeted for their research by political adversaries. Tor, the Onion router, uses encryption on the application layer of the protocol stack, like all the way on the top, and it's nested like the layers of an onion. It encrypts the data, including the next destination IP address, multiple times, and then it sends it through a random selection of Tor relays, and each relay decrypts one layer of encryption to reveal the next relay and pass the remaining encrypted data onto it. And then the final relay decrypts the innermost layer and it sends the original data to its destination without knowing the source IP address. Since the routing is concealed at every hop in the circuit, there's no single point to reveal the source and destination of the overall communication via network surveillance. So we would want to ensure that all outgoing traffic goes through this Tor-based network cube, so that's a Hunix cube, and we also would want to make sure that there's absolutely no traffic allowed to pass from other VMs. And then for outgoing traffic, we might also add rules to prevent information exfiltration by unknown programs. So the programs shouldn't phone home, right? We don't want that. And we want to prevent our machine from talking to ad providers and trackers, but might want to allow exceptions such as the DNS protocol, which allows us to write bobconf.de instead of an obscure IP address in the firewall rules, which is like hard to remember what that means for a human. In the original Cubes Mirage firewall created by Thomas Lennart, the rules were hard-coded and the Mirage kernel had to be recompiled and rebooted on each rule change. With the new version, we can use the Cubes menu to update rules while the firewall keeps running. For each network packet, the rules decide whether to allow or drop it at the firewall. How is this relevant for activists? Tor, the onion router that improves anonymity, might not be necessary for every activity, right? Tor is slower, but if you use it for everyday things, you add noise to the network of people who really need it. So it's good citizenship to use it once in a while. And our goal here is security in depth. So barriers like a firewall can help that bad packets cannot even make their way into the system. But we might also want to think beyond that, like what programming language we use for our security critical paths. OCaml is a good candidate here. It lets us use powerful functional programming features to avoid memory management problems and unnecessary state and exclude entire classes of bugs. In addition to that, it supports the use of theorem provers to prove the correctness of an approach. Testing the firewall to see who can access which parts of the network is surprisingly funky when we want to look at block traffic. Since networks are often unreliable, browsers, for example, have a rather long timeout, and we need to wait for it and see if the traffic was actually blocked. In general, we can use the same tooling as above, send a request and look at the traffic to see whether we got a reply. There's also a power tool called nmap for large-scale network scanning, but using it makes network admins and cloud providers mad since it generates a lot of probe traffic and lets you learn a lot about their network. To sum things up, security in depth means we need to think about more than security updating or patching our computers. We need to look into the network, but also the operating system and the programming language. It is worth considering alternative approaches here, or at least looking at them. Of course, everyone's needs are different. We have seen that it's interesting to try a few tools, play with Wireshark, and look at some traffic to learn what others can see. And in this way, you can also explore the network stack of your own computer. And also, don't lock yourself out. It definitely happened to us when working on the firewall via a shared connection. That's how we made really sure that it works. Thanks, everyone. Thanks also to my collaborators, Mindy Preston, everybody from the Robo team, and Marek from the Invisible Things Lab and from CubesOS, and also the Prototype Fund for funding this project. Feel free to contact us anytime. I did this work together with Mindy, and I'm gonna share the slides on my Twitter account. And happy to take questions and have a chat in the break. I don't know how it works here. Thanks, everybody, for listening. See you around. Bye.